This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Brandy Neuwirth spent her early years running around New York City, an independent kid who spent hours at the bookstore, loved school and the arts. Her extended family landed in the city after migrating from the South. Now, Brandy knew that her great-great-grandfather had opened a school in North Carolina, but she wouldn't discover the magnitude of Latta University until years later. Brandy had her own legacy to create, and her claim to fame would be developing Hollywood blockbuster films. Now a resident of the Triangle, Brandy has become the keeper of the family's history. She is chair of the Latta House Foundation and the community art coordinator for the United Arts Council of Raleigh and Wake County. Brandy Neuwirth, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be back.
We want to talk a lot about your career, which is a story in and of itself, as you will soon hear. But do take us back to your roots in North Carolina and tell us about your great-great-grandfather's vision and Latta University.
Well, Morgan Latta, Reverend Morgan Latta, he founded Latta University in 1892, and his idea was to provide skills to the children of freed slaves so that they could elevate their economic circumstances and really create a lot lives for themselves and their families.
And he did that in Raleigh.
He did. He did it in Oberlin Village, which is a very special, initial freedmen's village, right? That was created in 1865, right after emancipation.
So there are your roots. It's there, and then tell us it went on for a while, but it didn't continue. Talk about how it came to an end and how you came to be in New York City.
Right. Well, so at the school, they trained teachers and they trained lots of people with skills, but the students, of course, being the children of freed slaves, they didn't have very much money, and it takes a lot of money to run a school like that, especially a residential school. And ultimately, even though he traveled all around for many years to raise money for the school, at the end of the day, he had to close it because it just wasn't a sustainable model.
So that meant that your family then was, at the time, your great-great-grandfather and his family were then part of the diaspora and moved north.
That's right. They were a part of the Great Migration. Probably, we don't know exactly the year, but probably late 20s, early 30s, they made their way up to New York City.
Which is where you were born.
It was.
So talk about that. Growing up in New York City, and again, only vaguely aware of these roots. We'll talk more about kind of what you knew about that. But tell us more about growing up in the city, Upper West Side, right?
That's right. That's right. 92nd Street. It was a really special place at the time. My block in particular was a microcosm of New York City itself. At one end, you had Central Park West and the big high-rises. Mm-hmm. In the middle of the block, you had more middle-class families like my family. And at the other end of the block, you had public housing. So it was quite the mix and quite the education.
And we'll talk about your education because you were kind of bookish and also artish. Is that fair?
That's very fair. Very fair to say. I just adored books and adored the arts and really sought out any opportunity I could to be close to either, to spend time with either.
And your mother was also very, very helpful in all of this, making sure that you got into good programs, good schools, right?
That's right. My mom really she's a very intelligent person who is also very well-schooled in the arts, having gone to performing arts school in New York City herself. She really felt it was important for me to go to a place where I would have a strong arts education. And even beyond that, she made sure that I was in extra programs, so I got a lot of exposure to the arts.
Tell us more about that, about your mother growing up. She grew up in New York City. Did she grow up there too?
She was born in West Virginia, but she did grow up in New York City, yes.
And again, some education in the arts, went to fine arts schools. Did she have aspirations to become a performer?
Ultimately, she became a filmmaker, which is really what she wanted to do. She's a storyteller by nature. She was, if you asked her today, she probably would consider becoming a newspaper reporter because she's really interested in what's going on in the world and telling stories of what's going on in the world.
Now, what would that have been like for your mother in her generation to have aspirations as a woman, as a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker?
Mostly? A documentary filmmaker,
yeah.
Correct.
And what kind of work was she doing, and what kind of barriers, if any, did she face?
She did face some barriers. She worked in television. She did camera for Mets games for many years. So I had some fun times going out to the games. I would often get signed baseballs for my birthdays.
Well, it sounds like we need her on here to tell her story. Here's this woman doing Mets games on camera, what, in the 1950s or 60s?
No, this would be, 70s, this was actually maybe? 70s.
70s,
this was
70s, okay. Yeah. So things are breaking through a little bit.
Right.
How cool. And so also she was shrewd about getting you into these schools and giving you a certain amount of independence, but only, as it turns out, a certain amount of independence.
Only a certain amount. So it's very, I grew up on the Upper West Side, but my school was in Greenwich Village, which required a subway train ride, about a 30 to 40 minute subway train ride each way, every day to school. And it was very common at the time for children to take the subway to school by themselves. And that's what I started to do as a third grader. At 8 years old, or so I thought. I thought I was alone taking the train, and I found out later that she actually followed me for the first year to make sure that I was.
She went to school with you every day.
Yes.
Without your knowing it.
Right. So that I could feel independent, so I could learn what to do. And I thought she was psychic, really, because she would say things like, you know, when the whole crowd goes upstairs because the train has come in at a different platform, you should follow them. And I would think, well, how did she know? How did she know about that? Wow. And of course, it was because she was there.
I like to follow the crowd advice, you know. It's not if everybody's going to jump off, would you? But that's good. But the idea, and it never occurred to you that she these were just good guesses. This is the kind of guess moms make.
Right, absolutely.
That you needed to know these things.
Absolutely. It was only until my grandfather had to take over for her for one day that that he kind of spilled the beans. He waved at me across the street.
You don't wave at the subject.
And I thought,
when you're following.
Well, that's strange. I wonder why he's over there. Hmm. And that was pretty much the end of that.
That was the end of that. That's incredible. And again, not only, you know, making sure you get there and back, the advice that you need to make safe passage in both directions, but also, again, schools. What kind of programs were you involved in that she was, you know, making sure that you were part of?
Well, I went to a private school down in the village, and I had a lot of interests outside of school, even though school was wonderful. There was a lot of music education. We did musicals. We had symphony education, a lot of art education. I still have pieces that I made in art and shop. We had boys and girls had shop, which was awesome. I still have some of those things today. And outside of school, she created the opportunity for me to study ballet at Alvin Ailey for many years, which was just an incredible experience.
Were you then imagining yourself? I mean, was this just something you were doing for your edification, or did you imagine yourself with a career in the arts?
I absolutely imagined myself with a career in the arts. Both of my parents being artists, for me, it wasn't a done deal. But as a child, certainly, I just loved it so much that I figured that it was going to be something that was going to be in my life.
Did you have any particulars in mind?
I didn't, dance, and I thought probably writing, honestly. I enjoyed writing very much.
Well, then New York City through those years, but then in middle school, the family relocated to Washington, D.C., right?
We did. We relocated right before I turned 13 to Northwest Washington.
Now, that's a tough time for anybody to be moving, just to be alive. To be in the same place at 13 is hard, but how difficult was that for you to move?
It was a big transition, going from the independence of New York City, where I could go to a bookstore just because I could walk there, or I could walk to get an egg roll, or I could walk to the Museum of Natural History. It was a few blocks away, and I could go to the gem room anytime I wanted to just because it was so beautiful. It was a big transition because where we were in D.C., there's a metro line there now, but there wasn't then. So all of a sudden, I was stranded in some ways at home, which I was not used to.
What was it? Also culturally very different, I would think, D.C. and New York has to be.
It was. At the time, D.C. was still a little bit of a sleepy southern town, I would say. But at the end of the day, I really was appreciative of that move because it allowed me to relax in some ways. New York, when I was growing up, was still, you know, to be honest, pretty dangerous. And you had to learn to read people very quickly, and you had to learn to walk very quickly, and you couldn't make eye contact with anyone.
You had to have that face.
You did have to have the face. Mm. And in D.C., people would ask me, like, why was I mad? When I would pass them on the street. Mm. And I realized that that was a cue that I could relax a little bit.
And you did. You went to a school without walls?
I did. School Without Walls, it is still there today. It is on the campus of George Washington University, and it's a public school, a magnet school, so it brings students from all over the city, and the philosophy is city as classroom. So you can have, or I did have, American history at the Smithsonian American History Museum, zoology at the zoo. And I also was able to study Shakespeare at the Folger Shakespeare Library.
Yeah, that's a good city. If you're going to have the city as your classroom, that's a pretty good classroom.
That's the one.
We'll talk more about that and how you got some international training and leadership training through that move as well when our conversation with Brandy Neuwirth continues, great-great-granddaughter of Reverend Morgan Latta, the man who launched Latta University. That was a school that would educate former slaves located in what is now Oberlin Village. We'll talk more about that and about Brandy's career on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow talking to Brandy Neuwirth, chair of the Latta House Foundation, great-great-granddaughter of the founder, Reverend Morgan Latta, who founded Latta University, and someone who has had a career in her own right in film. And we'll talk about Bon Appetit magazine and talk about what you're doing here in the Triangle as well. But let's talk about what was going on in D.C., because School Without Walls, a philosophy that got you into the city and all of the many cultural treasures there to learn history and art. And also you got involved in Marion Barry's Youth Leadership Institute, which sent you abroad.
It did. And this, you know, of course, predated all of the scandals and whatnot. There was a Youth Leadership Institute that he had, and a group of 10 of us were chosen as youth ambassadors to represent the District of Columbia overseas. And we took a trip to the Middle East, and we went to Saudi Arabia. We were the first mixed group to travel to Saudi Arabia, meaning boys and girls traveling together in that country's history.
And what were you doing?
We were there to learn. We were there to learn about culture. We were there to learn about history. We were there to learn about politics. We traveled to both Israel and the West Bank, as well as Jordan, as well as Egypt.
What were you, now tell me, give me the years. What year was this?
This was 1986, so I was 16.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it would be an interesting time to be there, given our sense of what the Middle East was, our sense of the Arab world, and again, the conflict that was going on in that part of the world as well.
Right.
What did you come back with? What did it leave you with?
It really left me with a sense of what I discovered from talking to people, particularly on both sides of the Arab-Israeli conflict, was that everyone just wanted peace, the people that I spoke to. And it really compelled me to write about it, which is part of how I really became interested in journalism.
That meant you weren't speaking to the people who financed the conflict, because they didn't want peace and still don't. But
correct.
I take your point. You were talking to people who are suffering as a result and not profiting. And also, journalism was not surprising, given what you just said. Mm-hmm. You not discovered journalism, but discovered an interest in journalism?
I discovered an interest in journalism. I was able to join a program called Looking for Heroes. It was, I would say, you know, it was put on by Time Life, and they had us study the Odyssey for part of the year, and the other part of the year we actually looked for our own heroes and we interviewed them and wrote about them. And at the end of the project, we had a magazine, which for me led to a internship when I was still in high school at Time Magazine.
Who'd you write about?
I didn't get to write.
Your hero.
My hero. I wrote about Peggy Cooper K. Fritz, who was a big philanthropist mm-hmm. of the arts, African American philanthropist of the arts in the District of Columbia. And I also wrote about Father Wendt, who was someone who he had a very special class that you could take at my school called Death and Dying. Mm-hmm. And he taught everyone about how basically when you're a teenager, you are essentially grieving for the loss of your childhood. And that's why you're sad and depressed. So it was almost like a suicide prevention kind of class. Yeah. But in a way, it was also just, it helped to make sense of all of the feelings and, you know, sadness and hormones that everyone copes with at that age.
So you talk about the internship then. This net you an internship at Time Life or Time Magazine?
At Time Magazine first. Yeah. And it was the, you know, there wasn't yet a digital AP, Associated Press, right? So there was just the ticker. Mm-hmm. So I manned the ticker, as it were, and made sure that the different reporters on different beats got the information that they needed that corresponded to their beat.
Well, I'll tell you, my memory of that is that if that was your job, you were mostly just taking paper jams and fixing those and then replacing ribbons and then paper jams.
Exactly.
And then ribbons, mostly.
Exactly.
But there was some news occasionally that would actually make it across. So that's fascinating work. And now you're inside the belly of the beast. And yet you didn't choose. Well, talk about going to college and whether you chose journalism as your major.
Well, I got to do a little bit more work at Time Life. I did some research and writing for them 2 summers before I went to college. And ultimately, for me, school came down to a choice between going to the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern or going to Williams College in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, which is a liberal arts institution. And I decided that it was too early for me, even though I really enjoy journalism, I would do better to have a wide, range of experiences at a small college like Williams.
Yeah. But it turned out maybe a little too small.
It was a bit small.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bit small.
And I mean, for you, it's a wonderful experience for some people.
Yeah.
For others not.
It was a bit small. I treasure my experience there. It was small and remote was probably a difficult combination for me, having been a city kid all of my life. But, at the same time, I have wonderful friendships that I made there. And really, the education that you receive at Williams is par excellence. You can't beat it.
You took that to Los Angeles and went to UCLA.
I did, for film school.
So talk more about that and the decision. Again, it's between liberal arts and journalism at Northwestern. You take the liberal arts and that experience, but then now journalism seems to be taking a back seat. What grabbed you about filmmaking?
Well, having two parents that were artists, when it came time to start thinking about what I was going to do after graduation, the only thing that really seemed to make sense to me was to do something that was related to storytelling. And that was related to representation. And I'd taken a lot of art history courses at Williams. It's particularly known for that. And there was one course in particular in African American art that really grabbed me, that I really loved. And that led to a study of representations of African Americans in film. And ultimately, I realized that really what I wanted to do was to create new and better representations of African Americans in film. And, which does go hand in hand with journalism, because in a manner of speaking, both are storytelling from a different angle.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And you decided to go to UCLA, which is interesting given your history with the East Coast, growing up in New York. NYU's got a great film program. Was that a choice? I mean, was that a difficult choice for you, or why did you choose UCLA, I guess?
It wasn't so much a difficult choice for me, because I felt like, even though there is a very robust film industry in New York, I had always been taught to just really go for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly Los Angeles is the epicenter of filmmaking in the United States and in the world. And so I felt like that's where I needed to be.
So you get there and it is the epicenter. That's where the films are made. That's the industry. And now you get to, again, if not the belly of the beast, at least get a better view. You go in with the idea that you'd like to improve or representation, and then you see how the industry works. And I wonder if that was it all jarring for you or dislocating for you when you got there? I mean, what was your, because again, this would have been the late 80s, right?
This was 91
okay.
that I arrived in Los Angeles.
So what was the scene like for you and how did that, you know, or did it, were you still trying to manage your expectations for what you could do as a filmmaker?
Well, you know, there were, at that point, there were a few examples of what you could do. Spike Lee had just made Do the Right Thing that had come out just a couple of years before. And I believe X was released the same the same year that I arrived in film school. So I have to say that, you know, perhaps naively, I went in fairly empowered thinking
yeah,
that
yeah,
I'd
well,
be able
things are changing, yeah.
to do exactly what I wanted to do. And in some respects, I was successful. I was able to make some films, but in, you know, I arrived in the directing program and I figured out fairly quickly that what I really enjoyed doing was producing and putting all the elements together.
And so talk about what that means in the film industry if you're a producer, because I think when I hear producer, I think, well, they're the money behind this, but you're talking about the sort of the organization of it. So what does the producer do?
Right. So the producer pulls all of the elements together. The producer works with the, you know, often they'll find the writers. Sometimes they'll even find the material and find writers who will do a good job executing that material, turning it into a script. They'll also shop it to the studio, to distributors, to see who's going to pay for it, essentially. And then once you have a studio and you have money on board, at that point, you you find a director and you start to build a support crew for that director.
So you can start, what's fascinating about this, and it seems to be so complicated, is you can start at any point. Maybe you've got a script and maybe a director in mind, but you don't have the financing. Or maybe there's a studio that has this property and says, I think this novel would make a great script. You know, work your magic on this, right? So you can have many different starting points, it seems to me.
You really can. Yeah. It's like a puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, you have, you know, typically you'll have a couple of pieces to begin with. And every project is different, so the pieces that begin every project are different, and then you put them together as you go.
Wow, and succeed. You, right off the bat, you get an internship with Jodie Foster's production company, right?
Right. That was a pretty extraordinary experience. I was am a huge Jodie Foster fan. She's somebody who's really talented and takes her craft really very seriously. She also had a great staff. The woman who was running development at that time was Meg LaFauve, who was nominated recently for an Oscar for Inside Out. So to have the opportunity to learn story on top of just, you know, your academic studies in practice, she had us read all kinds of scripts. And then we would give our notes and then she would give us her notes on our notes. And
right.
That was a fantastic education.
What did you learn?
I really learned, I learned about story, and I learned how to, you know, how it was important to have characters that were very vivid and real.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's in as you go from there, well, I'm going to ask you more. I'm going to ask you this question about Jodie Foster, because as you say, this is somebody who, at least from the outside, it seems to me, does take her craft very, very seriously. I wonder if there's an aesthetic, if there's a reason she puts a production company together. One is because you know what you're doing, you can make it work. All right. But is there an aesthetic? Was she looking for certain kinds of stories to tell, do you think?
I think she was. And I think she was looking for not necessarily offbeat, but she was looking for maybe stories that might tell might be told from a different perspective. Yeah. You know, this is the era where she's a Nell. This is the era where she directs Home from the Holidays or Home for the Holidays. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for actors, it's a really big deal to be able to get your own deal and your own production company so that you actually get some control over your career and the kind of projects that you're interested in being in and creating.
Yeah, it must have been an interesting moment to be in Hollywood. As you pointed out, things were already beginning to change. Artists had a little more independence. And then once they gained that kind of recognition, you know, we're able to create those kinds of companies. You get to work for one. Then you work for Fox Searchlight, which was fairly new at the time, right?
It was brand new. I had a friend who worked at Martin Lawrence's company, and he had a deal at 20th Century Fox. And she called me one day and said, they need a second assistant for Tom Rothman, who was the newly appointed president of Fox Searchlight, and I'm going to call for you in an hour, so you better beat me with your resume. So that's a good friend.
Wow.
That's a good friend. And I met Tom, wow. And he's like he's a consummate producer, really smart, really good taste. He had put together a slate of films from essentially like six auteur directors. Like Spike and Bertolucci, and you know, and even he discovered a new one. He at that point had just discovered Ed Burns of Brothers McMullen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would say that Ed and I started at the same time. There was definitely a lot of like conversations, like waiting around for meetings where I would sort of talk to him about like, so did you shoot that on 16 or what did you do? And it was, you know, that was another education as well.
What was your job?
My job as second assistant was basically to read scripts and answer phones. It was very glamorous.
Yeah, but again, you're taking in all this information and I guess make recommendations, right? I think this will work. I don't think this will work.
Absolutely. And I will say that that's where Williams did come in very handy for me, is that once in my interview, once Tom found out that I went to Williams, pretty much, you know, I pretty much had the job.
Wow. Yeah. Why?
Well, Williams has a really good reputation for being a very good school, and he went to Brown, mm-hmm. and also Columbia, and I think he just understood of like, okay, you know, I can trust this person.
It's a kind of thinking. It's a way of approaching problems, right? That
it
isn't
is.
Maybe quite so vocational.
Right.
More open-ended.
It's an understanding of critical thinking.
Yeah.
I think, and an understanding of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely were able to, you know, to share that and have conversations on a certain level that I think ultimately he appreciated, because I wasn't an assistant for very long. I was able to move up to an acquisitions executive pretty soon after that.
Wow, that's pretty, and then from there you go to Vanguard Films.
I did. I just, you know, I loved acquisitions because it's all about screening films and going to film festivals, which was wonderful. But I really wanted to be creative. That's what I had come to Los Angeles to do. That's what I had come to the film industry to do. And Vanguard gave me the opportunity to come into a development and production role.
Vanguard, which made Shrek, right? I mean, to give you some idea of what Vanguard's all about.
Exactly. Right before I arrived, they had just made 7 Years in Tibet with Brad Pitt,
mm-hmm.
and Shrek was in development when I arrived.
So then what's your job with them?
So my job was vice president of development and production, and it was really my job to build up the live action side of that company.
Oh,
so
you got to work with real people.
Real people, real people, and real actors.
Yeah.
So I set about. It was my job to basically, you know, drum up material, find ideas, find things that would make good stories. One thing that I was really excited about that we weren't able to get done, unfortunately, there is a Chernow biography of Rockefeller that we tried to make with HBO, and unfortunately that didn't work out, and that was probably my one disappointment from that period. But you know, Chernow, of course, being the author of the source material for the musical Hamilton, But this, you know, predates that
by just a bit. So, Rockefeller, Hamilton, kind of the same. But no, but that's fascinating to me that that would be, first of all, that, that there was something about the way the material was put together that grabbed your eye, right? Mm-hmm. But again, Rockefeller, not a very glamorous character, not all by himself, right? A glamorous figure, although an important one in American history. But you figured, this needs to be made and can be made successfully. It didn't quite work out, but...
Right. Within a context. I thought, I thought HBO would be the right vehicle for something like that, for a, essentially a, a cable TV film at the time. And just, Turnell has a really amazing, talent of making things that can seem somewhat pedestrian or humdrum or everyday into something that's actually very interesting and insightful. Yeah.
You had another idea that became a Jackie Chan film. Tell us about that.
Right. So we made a film called The Tuxedo that did come from an original idea that I had. And that came from, interestingly enough, I was or am still a big Chris Farley fan. And Chris Farley had unfortunately passed a couple of years prior, but I was trying to think, okay, if I wanted to, what movie do I want to see? If I wanted to see a comedy, what movie would I want to see? Well, I'd want to see something with a, a Chris Farley or a Chris Farley type story. And then I just sort of in my mind started to think about essentially the idea, which is, what if you had a Chris Farley character and there was this tuxedo that when he put it on, it made him behave like he was James Bond.
We will talk more about how that idea came to fruition when my conversation with Brandy Neuwirth continues on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow talking to Brandy Neuwirth. Before relocating to the Triangle and joining the United Arts Council of Raleigh and Wake County, she was developing movies in Hollywood, and we were just talking about this idea that you had. What if a Chris Farley-like character were to become kind of supercharged in a tuxedo? Common idea. We all have that idea, but you, what a crazy idea. But talk about where this went.
It does sound like a funny idea to say it out loud again. At the end of the day, we thought that this really could have some potential. And so, of course, Chris Farley not being around, we had to think about, well, how are we going to execute this idea? Yeah. And Jackie Chan had just done Rush Hour with Chris Tucker and had a lot of success in his, in his comedic, in this comedic film, comedic action film. And we had a connection to Jackie Chan. So we were able to reach out and get him on board. And at that point, we took it to DreamWorks to see if they would be interested.
And what happened?
And they were interested. They bought it. They bought it.
And that becomes?
That becomes The Tuxedo, which was released in 2002.
See, this is what I love about the film world. And listeners will know that I'm not a huge fan of going to the movies. But what I love about the art of filmmaking was what you've just described here. This ability to know how the industry is working. Like, there's this actor who can do this thing, and they're already out there. That's important. They've got name recognition. And I have a story, and that's ultimate. That's creative. That's coming right from your soul and heart. And blending this highly subjective story that emerges from who knows where with a deep knowledge of how our culture works and putting that together and making it work, I think that's just stunning stuff. It must be stimulating. I mean, that's got to be thrilling.
Absolutely.
To be on the inside of that.
Absolutely. It was a dream come true, honestly, because that is what I had set out to do. I had set out to make films. And it wasn't necessarily, it didn't address the representation that I had in mind when I arrived. But I do think that it definitely, set me on a path, a footing to that I could follow perhaps to later make a difference.
Well, let's talk about that later and why, with things going so well, how you ended up here. Not that this ain't a great place to be.
Right. Well, I really enjoyed the film industry. The thing of it was that I was getting married. I, hoped to have a family. And the schedule of a film executive is not particularly conducive to having a family. You often would begin your day at maybe 7 a.m. for breakfast. And then you'll have, of course, meetings throughout the day. Lunch is always at 1 o'clock. You might have drinks at 6, and then you might have a dinner at 8. And then it's a repeat that potentially 5 times a
week. See, on the state of things, we have lunch at 1 o'clock. So, but we have drinks at 11 a.m.
Even better.
That's how we do the show.
Even better. So that just wasn't conducive. Yeah, so cool. I had to do something else.
So and again, you're going to get married. You have a child. And at that point, you decide that you got to go somewhere.
Right. And I decided that, before we came to North Carolina, I did have several years where I got to work at Bon Appetit magazine as a photo producer. And that just came about because I decided, I need a 9-to-5 job. What do I like to do? Here's my Bon Appetit magazine. I love Bon Appetit magazine, by the way, and still do. Huge foodie. Love it to death. And I found out that it was actually made in Los Angeles. So I started asking around all of my friends, does anybody know anyone who works at Bon Appetit magazine? And it just so happened that one of the writers of the Tuxedo said, yes, actually, my girlfriend works upstairs at Architectural Digest. She can probably put you in touch with somebody. It just so happened that a photo editor was going on maternity leave, and the rest, is history.
So you did, and this is great. I mean, you think about somebody, all of us have sat around saying, I really love that magazine. I'd love to be able to do something for them and leave my career in something entirely other. But we don't all do it, Brandy. I just want you to know that. All right, so there you are. How long did you work for Bon Appetit then?
I was there for about 5 years.
doing photo editing, right?
Doing photo editing. For the first 2 years, I was full-time, and I was able to go part-time once I had my son, which was a great service that they did to me. And I have to say that it's a wonderful environment to work in because they actually do test the food. And twice a day, a little bell would ring and you would go down to the kitchen and you would taste the menu of the moment and give your opinion. And at the end of that particular tasting, there would be what's called second bell, which was the cue to the office that everybody could come, and it was just time to eat.
Wow, that's great. Now, you said, we were talking just a little bit before the show, that the Thanksgiving issue was your favorite.
It was my favorite. Of course, magazines, you produce them much earlier in advance. And for Thanksgiving, we would be working on that probably in, February or March. And that was always my favorite issue. It was quite a lot of fun to be able to eat those things.
All right. So now you're still in L.A. You've got you've got your day to yourself. It's more conducive to raising a family. What brings you to North Carolina?
Well, my family and my husband's family were pretty much all up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And I felt bad that my mom had to get on a plane to see her only grandchild at that point. And also, L.A. was getting fairly prohibitively expensive. We looked around, at a lot of homes, and most shacks were about $1 million.
Okay.
And that just didn't sit well with me. It just didn't make sense. Mm. So we started looking around at where else we might go. And this area just kept coming up. The triangle just kept popping up. And so finally we took a look at it, really liked it, and made the move.
It's interesting because anybody wanting to make a move, particularly from these prohibitively expensive areas of the country, picks up magazines and does some research, and the triangle is constantly, in North Carolina in general,
absolutely,
is coming up over and over again. So just kind of a cold call, if you're looking for a place, North Carolina is good. How much of your own history, which is, we said, was really kind of at the fringe of your consciousness growing up, how much of that were you aware of as you made the decision to move here?
I was peripherally aware of it. I had heard growing up that my, this ancestor had this university, this school in North Carolina. But when you're a kid in New York City, North Carolina seems very far away. Mm-hmm. It's, you don't really quite understand, the relationship to where that actually is. So once we arrived, it was pretty exciting to be able to go to the site of the university that still to this day exists.
So tell us more about that, because now you've really taken responsibility for your family history here, how you became more and more engaged in the story.
Well, just the proximity has helped a lot. And I think my I've always, you know, been taught to be curious, and I've always been curious. And, you know, my journalism background of just wanting to investigate and understand things and tell stories, certainly, and to find this great family story that had not really been told in, you know, in any, you know, real, you know, appreciable way at that point, at least among my people, among my family, I mean, it really drew me to the story, and I felt like I really need to get involved and dig a little deeper.
Tell us more about the story. We did the broad outlines of this university that was created for people who had formerly been enslaved to help teach vocational skills that would then, you know, help them move forward. But give us more about what your great-great-grandfather was like and what it, the university that he actually created. Give us a picture.
Right. So he was born in 1856 on a plantation called Fishdam, that we now know is part of a network of plantations owned by the Cameron family, about 8 miles from Stagville. There's, I think, a string of about 9 plantations that goes from Stagville all the way down to Fishdam. Fishdam was the last one. So he's born there, and we know a lot about what happened to him there because he wrote an autobiography, which has an amazing treasure trove of information. He survived a lot of hunger, of course, and starvation by eating the cowpeas that were meant for the livestock. And he was able to understand that once emancipation came around, that he really needed to get an education in order to uplift himself and his family out of their present circumstances of sharecropping, which everyone knows is basically, you know, it's a losing model for the people who are the sharecroppers. So he attends a freedman school and is able to eventually go to Shaw University, get a classical education, and come back to actually go to Oberlin Village to found Lado University to share that type of education.
I mean,
with
it's
others.
Interesting that he chose that, because it's one thing to say, okay, look, I get what sharecropping is. This is just another form of what we had. They're offloading the risk. But and so you recognize that. You do better for yourself, and I'm sure it took some great effort and sacrifice even to get that education. Then he says, it's not enough for me to do this. I have to figure out a way to build an institution that can bring others along.
That's right. And it was interesting that, you know, in his book, he talks about how Booker T. Washington is a friend and someone who he admires. And you can see that in the way that he structured the university. It is very much in the Booker T. model, in that it is all about skills, and it is all about being able to get a trade. But there's another way of looking at it as well. He really does. I mean, he predates the Du Bois essay about the talented tenth, but which essentially says that you know, 1 in 10 African Americans should get a classical education so that they can become leaders of the community. And I feel like Lado was also really a pioneer in that, because he was offering that classical education. And we know that because we do have our course catalogs that exist.
Yeah.
That show the classes and the texts that they were using for algebra and Latin and literature.
Well, it's important that you say that, because I think it's always been unfortunate that we've sort of polarized the discussion in African American communities at the time between this kind of elitist look, we've got to break the model of thinking and move forward and demand full equality, which is something, of course, and the other is, yeah, but we need skills to sort of make a living, as though those were two poles, and one, you had to choose one or the other. And here's your great-great-grandfather saying, we need to do these at the same time. It's urgent that we do both now.
Right, right. And he was very much interested in race relations, and, you know, like Du Bois also, who felt that, you know, ending segregation was more important than, you know, having these trade schools and learning these skills. Lado really was trying to do it all, all by himself, or actually, you know, with, you know, a staff, of course, and a faculty. But it really was his brainchild to try to get it all done.
And you've now, again, taken responsibility for bringing a lot of this together and then bringing it to public attention. What's that been like for you, and why is that important that the rest of us know this?
Well, I think the story is just so inspiring. I think it can really inspire young people. It can inspire people who don't have very many means in order to accomplish what they'd really like to accomplish. You know, I was very fortunate in that I was raised in an environment where I had a lot of opportunities, not necessarily because of money, but because someone made a way for me to do that. And I learned how to make a way for myself to do things. And I think it's really important that other people learn how to make a way for themselves. And this story, I think, is a vehicle as a way to show how to do that.
And you made a recent trip to the plantation, and there was a kind of a homecoming and a gathering. Tell us about that.
That's right. So Reverend Latta was just recently inducted into the Raleigh Hall of Fame in the centennial category, which was such an honor. We were really so grateful to Raleigh Hall of Fame for doing that. And my family came into town for the ceremony. And the next day, we went out to Fish Dam Plantation, the ruins of it. I had been there once before with some great historians, Ernest Dollar from City of Raleigh Museum, Vera Chichelsky from Stagville, and Joe Lyles, who is an expert on Fish Dam and an old Fish Dam road. He took some students from Durham Math and Science, and they found the old Fish Dam road. So we were really fortunate to have him as a guide to go out there and find those ruins.
What was it like to be with your family now among those ruins?
It was a very powerful experience. Yeah. On the one hand, it's, you know, of course, very somber and sorrowful to walk through those woods. It made it a little bit easier that the plantation has now been essentially overtaken by nature. Fish Dam was actually flooded by the Army Corps of Engineers to create the Falls Lake Reservoir that provides Raleigh with all of its water. And I'd driven by it several times on the 85 on the way to Washington to visit my mother. And it always caught my eye because of the cypress trees, which I love cypress trees. And it was just very strange to find out that it was under my nose the whole time.
Well, we've talked almost this whole hour about your career, your family, and we haven't yet touched on your work at the United Arts Council. Let's do that now. What are you doing? What are you doing there? What's going on with the Arts Council?
Well, the great thing about the Arts Council is that it's involved in making art happen all over Wake County. Most people would be familiar with it because of our Artists in Schools program, which if you grew up in Wake County schools over the last 30 years, or you've got kids in Wake County schools, and you had an artist come through for an assembly or performance, you most likely have benefited from United Arts. And what I do there is I run the community programs. So we've got a mural program. We've got 5 murals up now in Wake Forest and Zebulon and Garner, Fuquay. We've got more coming. We're talking with other municipalities. And I'm working on a project with our artist in residence called A Year in the Life of the Arts of Wake County. It's in honor of our 30th anniversary at United Arts. And we have a documentary photographer by the name of Chris Gennaro, who's come down from Brooklyn. And he is photographing for us, trying to take a sample of all that we do in Wake County and also all that's going on in the arts in Wake County.
We'll have to have you back. Brandon Neuwirth is chair of the Latta House Foundation, also community art coordinator for the United Arts Council of Raleigh and Wake County. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking
Thank
to
you.
Us. You can find out more about Brandy and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnuson, Grant Hollab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director, Josie Taras, our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.